Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Okay, well, we're very, very privileged indeed to have Peter Hessler with us this afternoon. Peter Hessler attended Princeton University, where he majored in English and creative writing. And he then spent 2 years at Oxford, where he studied English language and literature at Mansfield College. After graduating in 1994, he traveled for 6 months in Europe and Asia. And one of the highlights of that trip was taking the Trans-Siberian train from Moscow to Beijing. That journey, which resulted in his first published travel story, was his first introduction to China. But then in 1996, Hessler joined the Peace Corps and was sent to China, where he taught English at a small college in Fuling, a city on the Yangtze River. In 2000, The New Yorker began publishing some of his stories, and the following year he became the first New Yorker correspondent to be accredited as a full-time resident correspondent in the People's Republic. Peter Hessler's magazine stories have been selected for the Best American Travel Writing Anthologies in 2001, 2004, and 2005, and also for the Best American Sports Writing Anthology of 2004. Chasing the Wall, 2004. First book, Rivertown, 2 years on the Yangtze, established him as a keen and sensitive Western observer of today's China. He currently lives in Beijing. He's obviously with us this afternoon to talk about and out of his new book, Oracle Bones, A Journey Between China's Past and Present, and then to sign copies of his book after his lecture. Please join me in welcoming Peter Hessler to the Boston Athenaeum.
And the weather is it's better than a sandstorm, I guess, which was what we had a lot of in Beijing this spring. I'm going to describe one of the stories that sort of winds throughout this book. It's a book that is concerned with history and also with the impressions that people have between nations, in particular the way that ideas move between China and the United States. And I want to focus on one of the people that I wrote about and some of these experiences. To start, I should give a bit of an introduction into how I returned to China. I was first in China in the Peace Corps, of course, from 96 to 98, teaching English. And then after returning briefly to the States, where I wrote a draft of my first book, I decided to return to Beijing in 1999 and try to set up shop as a freelance writer. And I didn't know anybody in Beijing, and it was my first time to try to make a living as a writer full-time. And I happened to arrive during a spring that had a number of very disruptive events, the most memorable of which was the NATO bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. I'm not sure if people would remember that. It was in the spring of 1999. It made news here, and of course it made big news in China. And it was one of these events that seem to happen periodically that reminds anybody who lives in one of these countries of how different interpretations can be and how different the viewpoints can be between the Chinese and the Americans. And this was intentional. This was an intentional attack. And of course, three Chinese who had been in the embassy had died. After the news broke in China, there were immediate protests. And in Beijing and in Shanghai, protesters gathered around the American embassy and the British embassy. And the protests became fairly violent in the sense of people throwing bricks and rocks and paint bombs. And it was a period where for a little more than a week, it felt quite tense on the street. It wasn't a comfortable time to be a foreigner. And it was especially true for somebody in my position because I had just arrived in the city. I didn't know very many people. And it just became part of your daily routine that anywhere you went, people would often confront you as a foreigner. And they would often ask, the first question everybody asked was, where are you from? And at that point, you decided if you were going to tell the truth or not. I knew friends who, a number of friends tried to say that the Chinese knew exactly which countries were involved with NATO, and so you had to even do that very carefully. And actually, even being Canadian wasn't good enough during this period. The other comment people would always say, well, you know, how could this possibly be a mistake? How is it possible that America, such an advanced country, could make a mistake like this? So during this period, I started doing whatever I could to avoid such conversations. I figured that I would try to ride it out. And I began spending Yaobaolu. This is close to the embassy district, and it's known as sort of a center for Russian traders. Russian and Central Asians often come to this neighborhood to trade for Chinese goods, often actually black market goods, things like knockoff name brand clothing, Pierre Cardin products or Tommy Hilfiger. The sort of things that are very cheap in China. And these are low-level traders, Russians who might come in, buy a few crates, and then go back, sort of working the margins. And it's quite a rough part of town, but it's also a part of town where, as a foreigner, I wasn't going to stand out as much. So I began taking most of my meals there. And in particular, I would often go to Islamic restaurants. Because, again, of course, the Islamic view of what happened in Yugoslavia and of the bombing campaign in Yugoslavia was very different from the Chinese view. Anyway, one evening I was having dinner in a small Islamic dumpling restaurant, just trying to mind my own business, and one of the at the table next to me was a group of Chinese men, and after a while one of them said to me, "Where are you from?" And I told him the truth, as I had been doing, because I knew that I was living near that area, and I felt like any sort of lie would eventually come back to haunt me. And then they began to ask the questions. And one of these men became stuck on this particular point of, well, America is such an advanced country, they can see anything from space. How could they possibly have bombed the wrong building? How could they possibly have made a mistake? Of course, from our current perspective, I think this question seems quite different. After watching the search for bin Laden and everything else in the post-9/11 period, our perspective on this particular issue is very different. But keep in mind, this was back in 1999, and America looked quite different from China. As always, I responded the same way that I did in general, which was to say, I don't know, I also don't understand. This event also confuses me. But it wasn't enough for this man. He kept asking, with such great science, he said, how could America bomb the wrong building? Kept going. And finally, at another table in the restaurant, there were a group of people who were Uyghurs from a minority group from the far west of China, and one of them spoke up and said, with such great science, how could America kill only 3 Chinese? and which, in its own way, was a very good response to a very good question. And, of course, at that point, the conversation changed entirely, and people forgot about me and began to focus on this man who was very happy to give his opinion about this. And his opinion was basically that if America wanted to kill Chinese people, all of us would be dead now. That was my first interaction with this person whom in this book I describe as Polat. He's actually the only character in this book that I give a pseudonym to for political reasons. And I had seen him in the neighborhood before, but we had never had a conversation. But after that, we began to meet regularly in this area and have dinner or lunch. I think we hung out a lot because both of us were lonely. I was new to the city, and he was an outsider. Both of us were outsiders. And neither of us liked going home, I think, was also part of the issue, because my apartment was $200 a month, which doesn't buy you much in Beijing, and his was even worse. So actually, I never saw his apartment, and he never saw mine, because we spent so much time out. We would often meet at a small Uyghur restaurant. I'm going to explain a little bit more about the Uyghurs in a moment, but we used to eat at a Uyghur restaurant, another Islamic restaurant that had it was on the corner, and it had a nice platform, an outdoor platform where you could sit when the weather was good and watch people walk by. If you ordered a beer, the boss at the restaurant would step down from the platform, open a manhole in the street, and take out the bottles, because that was the refrigeration system. The meals there didn't cost very much, needless to say. I think that might actually be mine. Let me turn this on. It was on silent, but I think it's affecting the reception. Okay. I'm sorry. I apologize. So we would often meet there and chatting and get to know each other. He was really the first time I had known a Uyghur, or the first time I had known anybody who was from a minority group in China. Now, our vision of China, I think, particularly from afar, is often of a very monolithic place. We think of the Chinese as a race, and we think of Chinese as a language. Neither is really true. If you travel across China speaking Mandarin, for example, you quickly realize that there are many other languages. There are many parts of China where I cannot understand what the locals say. And there are lots of ethnic groups. First of all, even within the Chinese, you see a huge range of the way people look. And really, you could probably have a different ethnic group in southern China from the ones in northern China or in eastern China. But particularly in the far west, where you have Tibetans and Mongolians and Kazakhs and Kyrgyz. And the Uyghurs are one of the most interesting and one of the least known of the minorities in China. They are from a place called Xinjiang, which is a huge part of the country. It's actually 1/6 of China's landmass. It's north of Tibet, and it's as big as Alaska and New York combined. It's mostly desert and mountains. It's a very stunning, beautiful landscape. And it's very poorly understood. It's like many parts of Central Asia, there has not been a lot written about Xinjiang, and there has not been a lot written about the Uyghurs. And in a sense, that's not surprising. They are sort of a moving target, in a way. The Uyghurs first came to that region in the 9th century, but they've always, many aspects of their identity have been quite fluid, even the name. They used to be called the Uyghurs in the 9th century, and then for a period of centuries, they no longer use that name and use different terms for different oases that they would live in. It wasn't until the 20th century that they began to think of themselves as an ethnic group, as a nationality. That part of the world, Xinjiang, it slipped in and out of Chinese control over the centuries. When the Chinese military was powerful, they would have garrisons there. When they were weak, it would often function basically as an independent place. The Uyghurs, even their religion had a tendency to shift. In ancient times, they believed in shamanism. They became Manichaeism. For a period, they believed in Nestorian Christianity. They became Buddhist after that. And then in the 10th century, they began to convert to Islam. And nowadays, they are predominantly Islamic. Their writing system also changed frequently. Their original script was runic. And then they developed their own alphabet. And then they began to write in an Arabic script. After the People's Republic came to power, their writing system was changed to Cyrillic. And then after the Soviet-China split, it shifted again to the Latin alphabet, and then back to Arabic. So sometimes when you think about what would it be like to be a member of this group and to try to understand your history, when even the basic writing system has changed 5 or 6 times over the centuries. And the more that I thought about the Uyghurs and got to know this person, Polat, the more I realized that, in a sense, it was the exact opposite of the Chinese. When I think of China, you think of a place that has a very strong sense of history. They have been writing with the same script for 3,000 years. They have a sense of continuous identity and continuous culture, a very powerful culture that has traditionally been in control of its past and in control of its political situation. And the Uyghurs were the opposite. And it was remarkable to me that both of these groups were contained within a single country. Whether or not they were similar or different, they both carried the passport of the People's Republic. And in a way, it was the first time I realized the sheer diversity of the country. Of course, the other difference with the Uyghurs, their language is Turkic. If they go to Istanbul, they can speak with the natives there quite easily. And they don't look Chinese at all. They tend to be bigger than the Chinese, and often they look Middle Eastern or Central Asian. I've known Uyghurs who are blonde, although many of them have dark features. And they had often traditionally served as middlemen, probably naturally enough, given that sort of flexibility in their culture and their position in the world. They had interactions with many different ethnic groups, and traditionally they had served as ways of connecting groups. For example, in the court of Genghis Khan, the Uyghurs were often the people who helped him interact with other Central Asian groups. They were good at languages. My friend Palat was no exception. He spoke about seven, and including Chinese. His Chinese was excellent, and also Russian. He did not speak English. And so our friendship was really a second language friendship. We communicated in Chinese, which was not his native tongue, and of course not mine. And this also gave me a new perspective. It was really, I think, the first time that I knew somebody entirely in a foreign language, in the sense of it was foreign to me and foreign to him. Palat was always interesting to me because he seemed quite educated. Most of the Uyghurs I knew in this neighborhood were from basically the trading class, and they did not speak Chinese very well. They did not talk about political issues or historical issues, but this person was different. His Chinese was good. He also had broad interests, but his business that he did was really basic. He was a money changer. In China, the currency is strictly regulated by the government, the exchange rate, and so there has always been a thriving black market. This was particularly true in 1999. And Palat, some of his business was on the black market, it could be quite profitable, but it was very dangerous, because anybody who changes currency carries a lot of cash. He also served as a middleman in trade deals. So if somebody came from Russia and needed to find a Chinese factory that was producing Tommy Hilfiger sweaters, then Palat would help them find that person because of his language skills. I'd like to read now from a description of some of his business and Palat himself. Palat sold just about anything. In 1998, he cleared $2,000 by arranging the sale of two truckloads of fake 555 brand shoes to a consortium of traders from Poland, Romania, and Yugoslavia. On another day, he earned a grand by helping some Russians purchase a shipment of knockoff Nautica clothes from an underground factory in Tianjin. There had been a lot of good days in 1998. That was the year he talked some Russians into buying 20,000 bogus brassieres made in Guangdong with labels that said Pierre Cardin. The margin on that deal was nearly a quarter a bra. I couldn't see the money on Palat. He dressed simply, and he didn't brag after closing a deal, unlike the other Yabalu traders. They were businessmen of the purest sort, dealing in fakes and playing the margins, and I learned not to take their stories too seriously. But Palat seemed different. He had wavy black hair flecked with white, and his eyes were brown and sad. He didn't smile much. His skin was dark brown, and he had the solid jaw and prominent nose of a Middle Easterner. When he did smile, his face lit up. He often used the Chinese word jiada, fake, and he was deeply scornful of the products that he sold. According to him, the knockoff clothes were garbage, crap, shit, jiada. Not long after we met, he mentioned that he had originally taught Uyghur language and literature at a secondary school in Xinjiang. He spoke so disparagingly of his business deals that I couldn't understand why he had left teaching. He was handsome in a rugged way, but his cheeks had lines so deep they looked like seams. He was slightly overweight. He smoked cigarettes constantly. He often looked tired. I had no idea what he did with his profits. He was always a mystery to me. I didn't understand why he traded, what his goals were, and I could tell there was more to him than my initial meetings. As I got to know him better, I learned that, in fact, he had had political problems. He had been a former teacher, and he had participated in some protests in Xinjiang, in his homeland, and he had spent some time in prison for that. And that was when he lost his teaching job and decided to seek a new life. And after I got to know him better, he told me that his dream was to go to the United States. That neighborhood where he traded, of course, as I said, was full of shady people, and it was also full of things that were fake. Jiada. This is a term that you hear almost everywhere in China now. I think it's simply because of the nature of the country, where you have this economic boom combined with a strong export economy, and there was something of a Wild West nature to the capitalism in China. It's probably quite similar to America in certain periods, maybe the Gilded Age or early boom periods. It's a wonderful climate for imposters and for people who are in business to trick others. It's also an amazing climate for fakes, that term jiada, you hear everywhere in China. I often have eat dinner with a family in the countryside outside of Beijing, and it seems like every time that I go to their home, they are watching a program devoted to things that are jiada, an expose of one sort or another. One time I was there, and the program was about fake train tickets. You buy a ticket, you get on the train, there's no seat. Another time it was about fake cooking oil. And another time it was about fake salt. And it was amazing to me that you could actually find a market and make a profit from fake salt. But in China during this period, nothing is too simple to knock off, and also nothing is really too lofty to knock off. I've been doing some reporting in a factory town in the southeast where there's a fake Sheraton. In another town not far from Shenzhen, you can stay at the Hyatt, or you can stay at the Hyatt. And there is something marvelous about the concept of an entire hotel being knocked off. In Yabalu, my friend Pulat and I would often have dinner at a place called Hollywood, which was a restaurant / nightclub. And it was a fake Planet Hollywood. They had knocked off the idea of a Planet Hollywood to the point of where when you walk through the entrance, there was a big statue of King Kong right above the doorway. And the first thing you saw inside was another statue of Arnold Schwarzenegger dressed as the Terminator. And then throughout this very shady and very dingy nightclub, they had decorated with what were supposedly movie props. Because if you go to a Planet Hollywood, they always have things from movies. And the fake Planet Hollywood had the same idea. For example, there was a glass case that had a black cape. And then it had a brass plaque that explained Dracula, Castle Rock Pictures, 1995. They had a sheriff's badge in another frame. And the label there said Sidekicks, Warner Brothers Pictures, 1991. They had a leather whip that was labeled Bullwhip, Columbia Pictures, 1958. Every time we went there, I wondered about how many degrees we were removed from reality. And when you think about it, these are movie props in the first place that are used on a film in imitation of some reality. But these were actually second-generation movie props. So we were at least three steps removed from the real thing. And it was often during our Hollywood meals that my friend Pulat talked about his desire to go to America. It often seemed very vague in the sense that as a trader who worked the margins in Yabalu, there was no way he was going to get a business visa to the United States. He was in his early 40s. He wasn't going to go as a student. And it seemed to me that it was impossible. I also often wondered about his concept of America. Throughout the time that I had lived in China, I'd often thought about this issue because as an American, Chinese were often talking to me about my country. And as a teacher, I had often been asked about America. And generally, I noticed that people tend to have very extreme ideas of what the United States might be. It was common to meet people who thought that the U.S. Is a paradise, where everybody has money and everybody is free. But you also met people that thought the United States was a terrible place, where everybody has guns and where the country is always invading somebody else. As an American, it was often frustrating to deal with such ideas, and I found that I sort of instinctively was generally trying to push people toward the middle somehow, toward a more nuanced view of what America might be. But it's very difficult from that sort of distance, because America really, to an average Chinese person, it's an idea, it's a concept, it's not a place, and it's not a collection of people. I had been to some parts of China where certain ideas of America had become so deeply ingrained that people would do almost anything to go there. There's a province in southeastern China called Fujian, which has always been famous for people leaving and going abroad, and in recent years has become quite known for sending a large number of illegal immigrants to the United States. There was a case in 2000 when a boat was stranded off the coast of Seattle, and when they opened up, it was a container ship, they found that three Chinese had died in the containers. About 20 people had been trying to be smuggled into the United States, and three of them had died. This made the news in America, and one of the Seattle papers commissioned me that spring to do a story about this, to go to these people's villages and try to see what the situation was, why people were leaving and taking such a risk. And so I traveled to Fujian. This was the same year that I would often meet with my friend Pilat in Hollywood. I took a trip to Fujian, and what was most striking was that this was not a poor part of China, relatively speaking. The economy there was actually quite strong. In fact, I met lots of workers who had come from Sichuan, where I had served in the Peace Corps. To the people from Sichuan, Fujian looked like the promised land, but the people in Fujian were already looking elsewhere. For them to go abroad, it often cost $30,000 to $50,000 U.S. to get a legal passage to America. This meant, first of all, that these people were not poor. Obviously, they would often borrow money, and sometimes they would have to work almost as an indentured servant in the United States to pay that off. But simply by being able to raise some measure of cash on this order, you have to be at least middle class in China. But the truth was that they had simply become obsessed with this idea. I went to a small village outside of the city of Fuzhou, a very tiny village, and everywhere I went in the village, there were advertisements for English classes. As an English teacher, I was interested, but these were unlike anything I had ever taught. There was one class that was called Restaurant English, because so many people were working as waiters or cooks or waitresses. There was another class that was called English for Leaving the Country. One of the ads read, "For the money you'll make in a day and a half working in America, you can study a full semester of restaurant English." There was one class that was simply called Menu. And I'd like to read a description of this town. A number of locals had made the trip, worked hard, and eventually became the owners of restaurants or some other business in the States. They remitted money to family members back in Fujian, who built enormous mansions in the villages. These structures tended to be narrow and vertical. They might be only 3 rooms wide, but 5 stories tall. Usually, they were faced with white tile, and often they had big glass windows in the shade of green that was so common in modern Chinese construction. That color always made me think of the Great Gatsby, the glow at the end of Daisy's Dock. But in Fujian, it was like glimpsing light that had taken years to cross a galaxy. Some of these success stories had belonged to an earlier generation, when China's economy didn't provide much opportunity. In truth, nowadays the Fujianese might be better off staying at home. Even if the immediate dollar figures were higher in the States, they'd probably be happier and have better long-term prospects in China. But the people kept seeing the mansions, and they kept leaving. They were chasing a star that might be dead by the time they got there. So I often thought about this issue, how things move across great distances. How do people create a vision of something far away? And of course, as a teacher, I had been very conscious of this, teaching Chinese students American and English literature. And as a writer, I was conscious of it because I was writing about China for an American audience. And when I had conversations with Polat in Beijing on Yaobaolu, I would often try to give him a more realistic view of America. And after that trip to the South, I told him how I believe that the people in this area in Fujian had created a vision of America that probably wasn't accurate and that wasn't in their best interest. And he explained to me that he was different. He said, first of all, that he wasn't stupid enough to pay $50,000 to get onto a container ship. But he also said that his issue wasn't economic. He said he was different. He didn't want to go to America because of the job opportunity. He wanted to go for political reasons. Regardless, I didn't think that it was possible. And I figured that maybe he was just something that he talked about as a way to have some sort of escape, some sort of imaginative release from his current situation. But then that summer, I took another trip away to do some reporting. I came back, and we had dinner, and he said, this is the spring of summer of 2000, and he said, I'm going to the United States. And I asked him how he had done this, and he said he had been hanging out near the American Embassy in Beijing, and he met somebody who gave him a business card, and the business card was from a company whose Chinese name meant the Cultural Exchange Company Limited. And what this person offered to do was help Polat find an identity that would allow him to go to the United States. The cost was $8,800. The price had the two eights because eight means good luck in China. And for $8,800, he received a round-trip plane ticket, which he only intended to use half. And he also received new paperwork. In China, China is an authoritarian country where there is certainly a remarkable amount of registration and paperwork, and a huge amount of energy goes into bureaucracy. But with the kind of society that is moving so quickly and has so much corruption, there are often holes in this system, and this is what this company exploited. They sat down with him, looked at his passport because he already had one, and they created a story for basically a new identity under the same name. For example, every Chinese citizen has to have a residence card, and they gave him a new residence card that said he had four children, even though he had none and had only recently married. They gave him documents from the Bank of China that said he had $300,000 American in the bank, in an account. With so much money and with so many kids, anybody at the American Embassy would know that he would certainly return to China. They also gave him registration for a trading company. They said he was a businessman who had a company in China, and they gave him registration for an advanced degree. So his education suddenly went up a couple of notches. All of this had already been worked out by the time I returned to Beijing, and I was quite surprised. And I said, aren't you afraid that with these sort of fake documents you're going to have trouble? And he said, these documents are not jada. They are not fake. They're completely real. It's just the information within the documents that's jada. Because the connections, his point was that the Cultural Exchange Company Limited had such great connections that they could get the real thing. He just had to make up the story. As I said, by the time he told me this, it was already a done deal. And his interview at the U.S. Embassy had gone smoothly, and he had the visa. And I said, well, where are you going to go in the United States? He was flying to Los Angeles. And he said, "Why? There's Uyghurs, people who I will visit in Washington, D.C., and New York, and Los Angeles, and Oklahoma City." I said, "What was the last one?" And sure enough, somehow, a number of years ago, some Uyghurs had gone to Oklahoma Baptist University, had received scholarships there, and then other Uyghurs came to visit them and to stay and found jobs there. And sure enough, a small community from this ethnic group had settled around Shawnee, Oklahoma. And this made me wonder how many places you could go in America and find some obscure ethnic group that you had never heard of that was somehow making a new life for themselves. And sure enough, when he arrived in the United States in Los Angeles, the first thing he did was buy a one-way Greyhound ticket to Oklahoma City. He told me that it felt very remote, and it felt like a bad place to be a minority. And so he kept going after Oklahoma City, and eventually he went to Washington, D.C. And I would often receive phone calls from him. He never said much on the phone, because he knew that as a journalist, my phone was possibly being listened to. But he told me that the next time I was in the States, I should visit. And I'd like to read a bit from the description of his arrival in Washington, D.C. He ended up, D.C. is the center for most of the people from his ethnic group who go to America. And when he was there, his first act was to move into an apartment where a number of other Uyghurs had already settled. They were all applying for political asylum. This had always been his plan, was to apply for political asylum. And in the meantime, he found a home at the corner of Franklin and Rhode Island in Washington, D.C., which is a pretty rough part of town. It was interesting because when I visited later, one of the first things I realized was it had been a long time since I'd been to a city that didn't have any economic activity. When you went to his neighborhood, there were very few businesses. Most of them were boarded up. The few that were there, there was a liquor store called the Good Old Reliable Liquor Store. There was a pawn shop. There was a tiny grocery. And all of the businesses were run by immigrants. And everything else was housing projects. And it was so different from China, where every urban landscape is an economic landscape. Every urban landscape in China, no matter how rough the city is a place where people are doing business. Palat told me, he said he was confused because he had seen other people in this neighborhood buying groceries and things with pieces of paper that weren't money, and he didn't know what that meant. And so when he arrived, many things like this were a mystery to him. And I'll read from one of his introductions to the United States. Shortly after Palat moved into the apartment, he read the classified section of a Chinese language newspaper and noticed an advertisement for driver's license consulting. The service was based in the district's Chinatown, and for $150, the consultants offered to provide the paperwork for a Virginia driver's license. Among the immigrant community, Virginia was known for its loophole. Applicants for driver's licenses and state identity cards didn't have to show proof of residence or even identity. The only requirement was a notarized affidavit testifying that the applicant lived in Virginia and had valid documents. It was possible for an out-of-state illegal immigrant, in other words, somebody like Palat, to acquire a Virginia driver's license without ever showing his passport to a government official. Non-English speakers were also allowed to bring their own interpreters to the examination. The Chinatown service arranged Palat's affidavit, no questions asked, and they also sent a Chinese man to accompany him during the written exam. Whenever the Chinese man came to the correct answer of a multiple-choice question, he muttered, "Da ge," which means big brother. Big brother, big brother, big brother. Palat passed with flying colors. After receiving his license, he bought a silver 1992 Honda Accord for $3,100. One evening that winter, Palat tried to call his mother in Xinjiang, but the apartment's phone service was cut off. He decided to use the public telephone near the corner of Rhode Island and Franklin. It was almost midnight. The payphone was right across the street from the Good Old Reliable Liquor Store. While he was punching the numbers, a man came up from behind and said something that Palat didn't understand. He ignored the man and kept dialing Xinjiang. Before Palat could finish, he felt something pressed against his back. He whirled around and saw that the object was a handgun. Two men, one with the gun, one in a car. "Lay down," said the gunman, and this time Palat understood. He dropped down. The gunman searched him. He found $70 in a front pocket, but somehow missed $300 that Palat had stashed in another pocket. The two muggers drove away on Rhode Island Avenue. Palat picked himself up and hurried back to the apartment. He'd been outside for less than 5 minutes, and he'd been in the United States for less than 3 months. in a way, this story gave me a sense, first of all, of how in these massive countries like China and America, there was always a way to move beneath the surface. No matter how impressive their systems might seem, there was always some other way. And it also, of course, the story became more, he was robbed at the beginning of 2001, and later that year he was in Washington, D.C., when 9/11 happened. And of course, after that, he became a non-English-speaking Central Asian immigrant in the United States at a very difficult period to have that profile. He was lucky in the sense that he had received political asylum before 9/11, but in all the other senses, he was unlucky. And I became fascinated by his story in part because he was an outsider in China, in the Chinese capital of Beijing, and then I saw him again as an outsider in America, in the American capital of Washington, D.C. And getting to know him and knowing his perspective made me think more about these massive countries and what it feels like to be on the peripheries. And of course, it also just makes me, it also gave me a new realization of some of these world events. For example, on 9/11, 7 of the 19 hijackers had Virginia driver's license or identity cards that had been acquired in the same way. And so the week of those attacks, that particular loophole was closed. And it made me realize that somebody like Polat, who actually had legitimate political grievances and who I respected as a decent person, had found the exact same avenues that people who were involved in terrorism had also found. That story is continued in this book, but I'd like to leave some time for questions now. So I'd like to end this part of it and then see what people in the audience have to ask. So if anybody has a question, just let me know. Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks. Okay, the title is Oracle Bones. Where does that come from? This is a book that's mostly concerned with contemporary China, with present-day China. But there was also a strain of it that concerns the past. And in particular, I'm looking at Oracle Bones are the earliest known writing in China. These are artifacts that were inscribed 3,000 years ago by the Shang, a civilization known as the Shang. And in a very literal sense, it's the start of Chinese history. I was also interested in the Oracle Bones because they were rediscovered about 1899, which was a real low point for China. This was a period when the country was being broken apart by invaders and the Qing dynasty was about to collapse. And many Chinese intellectuals worried that their civilization was not going to survive. And actually, if you look at the history of the study of the Oracle Bones, the excavation, the people that were involved, you get a remarkable window into the 20th century China, because every event ranging from the Boxer Rebellion to the fall of the Qing to the May 4th movement to the Cultural Revolution, every major event wove through affected the study of these artifacts. And I was also fascinated when I met the scholars because their job is to piece together these bits of the past and somehow create meaning of them. And I felt like that's very similar to what I do as a journalist, trying to live in China and create a coherent picture for Americans. And also reminded me of what people like Polat do, or the people in Fujian, who are looking across the ocean in some way and trying to get a sense of what's far away. So whether it's across space or across time, something about that process is similar and interested me. And so the title is partly for symbolic reasons, but there are sections in this book that deal with the history in China. And the significance of that. Mm-hmm. The question is whether Xinjiang has been a province of China or independent. I mean, you have a radically different answer depending on who you ask. In truth, for much of history, nobody controlled it with consistency at various periods it would be annexed by the Chinese, and then in various periods when the Chinese Empire was weak, it would basically be independent. It became a formal part of the Qing Dynasty in the 19th century, Has anybody ever eaten General Tso's chicken at a Chinese restaurant? Probably have. General Tso is the general in the Qing Dynasty who brought Xinjiang under Chinese control. And naturally enough, Polat, the person I wrote about, ended up delivering food for an Asian restaurant in Washington, D.C. that made General Tso chicken. So the levels of irony and meaning and historical significance can be interpreted forever. During the 1900s, this region, like many parts of Central Asia, began to get a new sense of nationhood and identity, and that's while the Chinese Empire was getting weaker and was torn apart by invasion and civil war. And from 1944, Uyghurs and Kazakhs and White Russians declared an independent republic called East Turkestan. And that independent republic functioned basically as an independent country until 1949. When the People's Republic invaded. Actually, in 2004, I happened to be in Washington, D.C. for the 60th anniversary of the founding of the East Turkestan Republic. And Uyghurs from all over the world gathered in Washington, D.C. They rented out a hall at George Mason University and had an event where they dressed up in the old military uniforms. And so it was an amazing thing to see this country that had been not a part of the roster of nations for half a century, and these people trying to memorialize it in their own way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I visited China last fall, and what struck me is the juxtaposition of the communist regime with what was the most extraordinary capitalist regime, and how could that happen? It's contradictory.
Yeah, well, I think it's a good question. It's one that... The question is, how do you have the juxtaposition between the communist authority and the capitalist energy that we see day to day on the streets in China? You know, which is, it's an impossible question to answer. I think this has never happened anywhere else, in that the leaders, the Communist Party is still in charge, but it is an amazingly capitalist place. That's one of the reasons I became interested in Polat's story and in Yabaloui's. It's one of these neighborhoods where you feel the power of this economy and the sort of the business sense that so many people have. I think what it comes down to is pragmatism, basically. I think that the Chinese went through a crisis in the 19th century. I mentioned this when I talked about oracle bones, how these objects reappear during a real crisis for China. And when they suddenly realized they were weaker than the outside world, they realized that their vision of the past, of a continuous history, their obsession with the past, had somehow made it hard for them to have progress. And they struggled with this for generations. And often they struggled with ideology. And they would have all kinds of big ideas. How are we going to reform China? How are we going to change China? Of course, communism came out of this. That's the one reason why communism became successful there. And, of course, it didn't create anything but more trouble for the people. And I think after that experience, they were sick of ideology. By the time Deng Xiaoping came to power, the Chinese no longer wanted to deal with these big ideas, and the solution was pragmatism. Just let individual people make their own way in an economy that is freer than what we've had. And that's basically been the agreement. So it's communist in name, but I think really it's an incredibly pragmatic society right now. And that's, if there is an ideology, that's it. Mm-hmm. Okay. The question is that Polat is one of the characters I follow, and who are the others? Actually, two of the other main characters are former students of mine who I taught in the Peace Corps. And these are people who I kept in touch with after they graduated and watched their experiences as young Chinese in this new country, in this new economy. Both of them became migrants. Migration is one of the themes, one of the major developments in China today. People from the rural areas moving to the cities. And I follow their experiences as they go to the boom towns on the East Coast and the Southern Coast. Like Polat, these are also people who have left home. And really each of the main people that I look at in this book is somebody who is on the move in one way or another, who is leaving home, trying to go somewhere. I think this, again, is something you feel very strongly in China today. A nation that traditionally people stayed close to where they grew up, suddenly people have the freedom and also the interest in moving and going elsewhere. And so this is a theme that I explore in this book. And the final main character is connected to the story of the Oracle Bones. in that I mentioned that I became interested in the history of these artifacts, and in particular the story of one man who was named Chenmengjia, and he was a poet and a scholar, a brilliant man who spent time in the United States doing research, returned to China, and was hounded to suicide during the Cultural Revolution. And I started pursuing his story out of curiosity, and then I realized that it was teaching me a great deal about Chinese history, and I also realized that by investigating his story, I was coming into contact with a lot of people in their 80s and 90s, because I talked to his brother, his brother-in-law, his students, I talked to the person who was on suicide watch when he killed himself. I talked to the person who criticized him, a former assistant who turned against him during one of these political campaigns. And in the process, I, of course, got windows into his story, but I also had more contact with older people in China. One problem with being a reporter in China today, I think, is you can be very focused on the young people, and the young people often are not concerned with the past. And you can miss a lot, I think, by just being wrapped up in that generation. And I became interested in his story in part because it brought me into contact with older people and gave me a new window into where China had come from, helped me understand the background.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if some of you have had the opportunity to show your book to some of your friends in China and what their view of their book is and whether they have concern mm-hmm. about their life being exposed.
Mm-hmm. Right, the question is about Chinese response to this book. The main characters had read the sections, partly for fact-checking reasons. As I said, the one person who I didn't want to use his real name was Polat, who, you know, we talked at great length about this. His story was already, I already wrote about him in The New Yorker, and when I worked on that story, he told me that he wanted to use a pseudonym. He wanted the story to be published because he believes that his ethnic group is not well understood. And so he wants Americans to be aware of where they come from and what their background is. But he didn't want his name to be used. As far as in the general market in China, it probably won't be published in Chinese. It's too sensitive. Even my first book, River Town, was less sensitive than this. And I was offered a contract by a Chinese publisher. But they told me that they were going to have to change things. So I didn't sign it. It's an unfortunate thing in China because actually I find that people don't respond negatively. When I wrote River Town, I was very concerned about how people in the town were going to respond. This book is a little bit different because I was a journalist when I came to China in 1999. I was a writer. The people that I am talking to, they know what my job is. But when I was in the Peace Corps, I was originally a teacher. I wasn't there to write a book, and I didn't plan to do that. It wasn't until the end of my experience that I decided to do that. So I was always very concerned about local reactions. And I've been very surprised that the people I knew in Fuling are very positive about the book. And I think there's probably a number of reasons for this. And one of the more interesting ones, I think, is they were a little bit nostalgic about it. Because even though it's not that long ago, lots of things have changed in that town, like anywhere in China. The progress moves so quickly that if you know, 7 or 8 years can seem like decades ago. And when I talk to people in Fuling, they often laugh when they remember these things. It seems very, very far away to them.
Mm-hmm. I was curious about the fact that in 1999, when you arrived in Beijing, you had to pay $200 a month for an apartment. It was miserable. Mm-hmm. Are housing prices just very different from that? Was it because you're a foreigner? Or mm-hmm.
Right. Right. The question is about prices in China, basically, in that she's noticing that food in China was very cheap, but I was paying $200 for a bad apartment. This is actually kind of a foreigner issue in the sense of restaurants are real cheap, and most of what you buy day to day is incredibly cheap. It's a little more complicated to move into a place. Because you have to be registered and so on. And so usually foreigners end up paying more. For example, when I did move into that apartment, it was very complicated because almost immediately somebody in the apartment complex told the authorities and the police came and we had to register and find some story of why I was in China. Of course, my landlord wanted to tell them that I was Uyghur. That was his idea. which I thought was a very bad idea, because this is a group that has a lot of political problems, and I didn't want that sort of scrutiny. But that sort of complication makes it a little more difficult to move in. How do you spell Uyghur in English? There's actually, characteristically, there's a couple of different ways to spell it. The one that I use in this book is U-I-G-H-U-R, but you also see it spelled as U-Y-G-H-U-R. It's a Turkic word. I think that word means culture in Turkish or something to that effect. This is one of the stories that I track in here. And the thing is, he received political asylum before 9/11, which was very fortunate. But his application for her to come in did not make it through before that event. And after that, it became very uncertain what would happen. And eventually, she refused to come. And so they basically divorced because she waited for a year, and then she felt like it was too uncertain. So it's a very sad story, in a way. And you sort of have this sense of somebody who, you know, his was caught in a historical event that he had no, obviously none of us had any control over. I think we should just take one more question, is it? Okay, one more question back there.
Are you still reporting from China?
Mm-hmm. Am I still reporting from China? Yes. I'm actually working on another book, which concerns partly a village where I've lived in outside of Beijing for a number of years. And partly I'm also doing some reporting in a factory town in the southeast of China, which is really amazing to sort of watch how things move in these areas. I'm combining I'm looking at one picture of rural China, and then I'm looking at a factory actually, and watching how businessmen are setting up this factory. How do they get the equipment? How do they hire the workers? And that's turned out to be, you know, an amazing thing to see. You have quite good access now in China. It's much easier to talk to people and to get around. And when I go to places like this, I can just sit in and watch what they're doing. So, you know, I've always found the reporting there to be very productive, and I'm hoping to finish the research this year and then write the book next year. Anyway, I think that's it today. Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it.